Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion. It is my great pleasure to welcome Kevin Eikenberry and Wayne Turmel, who are co-authors of an amazing book called The Long Distance Team. I'm very excited about talking to you both because remote work and hybrid teams are such a hot topic, but they're also my everyday because I have a team and I have clients all over the world and partners all over the world. So I'm excited about being a student today. But I'd like to start with your story, a little bit about your background and how you came to write and work together. So whoever wants to go first.
Well, we found each other a long time ago in a virtual world. Wayne hosted a podcast long before podcasts were cool, called The Cranky Middle Manager, and I was on it a couple of, I don't know how many times. He says it's more times than I think it actually was, but I was on his show a couple of times, and that led to us having a relationship, if you will, professional relationship at a distance. Then we later met, and eventually we collaborated on some things together. And then eventually it's like the old Gillette commercial. I liked the product so much, I bought the company, and that's what I did. Eventually I bought Wayne's company and he became a part of our organization. And that's the short version of how we got together. Wayne, why don't you talk about sort of the books, well, the book and the book process?
Yeah. Well, the synergies go back to the beginning. I was running a company that was primarily focused on distance communication and virtual communication. Kevin was running a very successful consultancy based on his book, Remarkable Leadership. And I was getting lots of questions about leading remote teams. He was getting lots of questions about working remotely in virtual work. And rather than invent two different wheels, we just came together. And so when the idea for Long Distance Leader came out, which was in 2018, we had been standing on that corner, if you will, for a while. I have spent almost 20 years looking at remote work and virtual communication. Kevin, you know, has been concentrating on leadership.
And leading a remote team for over a decade.
And he's been living it, you know, for over a decade. So Long Distance Leader came first, and it was, why does this feel so different and strange? And then Long Distance Teammate was for the individual who wanted to be connected and be a good teammate in this new environment. And so Long Distance Team is kind of the logical culmination, because you can do your best to be a good leader and do everything you can to be a good teammate, but the structure and design of the team and the culture of the team is ultimately going to determine how successful you can be. So this is the logical culmination of that, if you will. And interestingly, I mean, Kevin and I have known each other the better part of 15 years. We have never been in the same room at the same time more than four times a year. And this is the third book. And in the last two, we did not see each other physically at all during the writing of them.
100% true.
So it can be done.
So we're going to dive deep into this long distance team and leadership and culture. But before we do, as a writer, how do you co-write a book? What is your process for that?
Well, I don't know what other people's process is, but I've written three with Wayne, and I wrote a book called From Bud to Boss with Guy Harris. And I can tell you what our process is.
Yeah.
And our process is you have an outline for the book, and you identify what the chapters are going to be, and you know what you're going to write about. And then what Wayne and I have done three times now is say, okay, who's the best person to write the first draft of each chapter? And so fundamentally, we each write the first draft of half of the chapters. And then as the drafts are created, We use Word and we mark them up and we individually asynchronously look at them, comment on them, et cetera. Then we come back together and work on them together, and with the intention of not only getting the content really where we both want it, but also getting it so that when people are reading it, they can't say, oh, that was a Wayne chapter and that was a Kevin chapter, but that it reads with one voice.
Yeah, we have very different writing styles. And yet, you know, together we've managed to create this where you can't tell a Wayne chapter from a Kevin chapter, as he says. And so this notion of everybody takes their first shot and then you shut up and listen to the feedback from the other person, which is really key to this.
Is well, I think there are parallels. I'm sorry, Wayne. There are parallels. I mean, you know, we are doing work at a distance. It happens to be work called writing a book, right? When I'm working with leaders, I often say, hey, listen, I'm a leader just like you. The work of my team might be different than the work of your team, but what we share in common is leading. And what the commonality in this story is that we're doing work at a distance, right? The work might be different than, but the combination, it's instructional to think about that we do it in a combination of both synchronous and asynchronous collaboration, using a variety of tools, using our webcams, using a lot of the things that we would be encouraging people to do, and people ought to be getting, even continuing to get better at, to be effective in a long distance working life.
But I think we undersold something really important, Kevin, and I was listening to you describe it. You said, well, we sit down and we talk about what the chapters are going to be. That's the hardest part of the process, is figuring out what is the scope of the book? What are we going to tackle? What is the essential viewpoint? That's the hard work. That's a lot of discussion back and forth before we ever sit down to do the work. After that, the worst work is task completion.
And that's true, right? And you know, again, Laurel, I don't know how far you want to go into the book writing process, right? But there's a front end around not only what's the message for the audience, but how does it fit in to our business and our products and services and deliveries and all the other stuff, right? And then because this is three books in a series, we've got some things that we wanted to hold similar, right? So there are some things that are in each of the books, like stories to open each chapter, and these sorts of things that have evolved that become a part of making it, in the end, a cohesive whole.
No, I love that. And I love that it's a real demonstration of how effective remote working can be. Because you are a team of two that knows how to produce things and produce things well. I'm also curious about the four times a year when you're together. How is that different than when you're on...
Well, it's not always been four. Sometimes it's been more like, you know, one or two. In this case, it's not just Wayne and I, but because, you know, he is one of the members of our team, it's typically there are several of us together. So when he says we're together four times in a year, it isn't that we're together four times and now we're going to roll up our sleeves and both sit at our computers and type, but we're doing other sorts of work. We're doing planning work, we're doing strategy work. We might be at a conference at the same time, but speaking together or something like that. You want to add anything to that, Wayne?
No, I think that's, you know, my point of saying that, it was a rough average. I mean, when I lived in Chicago, I could drive down to Indianapolis three, four times a year, or if something came up, you know, it's a 3-hour drive, it's easy. Now I'm in Las Vegas, and oh, by the way, we lost 2 years to a germ. So, you know, it's not like it's this steady cadence of meeting. It's, do we make the most of the time that we are together? And we are doing a lot of other work besides the book writing. But maybe more importantly, it's kind of like the old vaudeville act with the plate spinning. We get the plate spinning when we're together. We get a chance to really make sure that everything is going fine. And then we go back to what we're doing, which I think is the basis of hybrid work, is, you know, the work is getting done, it's getting done remotely, but when you do get together, do you maximize that? Do you turn that into valuable time that gives you the momentum to go back and do what you're doing separately?
And in our case, that might be 2, 3, 4 times a year. And in somebody else's case, that might be once a week. But the point is, if people are coming, I mean, you've heard it, People are saying, why do I need to come to the office? I'm going to put my headphones on and do exactly the same thing at home. I said, then you shouldn't, right? The days that you come in, there should be fundamentally different. Maybe not every moment of the day, but the nature of the work should be different when we have the chance to be together versus when we don't. And so taking advantage of that, getting those plates spinning a little bit faster, re-energizing the team, building our relationships, further building trust. Can we build relationships and trust at a distance? 100%. Are there benefits to doing it together? 100%. And we should be taking advantage of the advantages of being in proximity and the advantages of being by ourselves.
That's actually, you know, what Kevin just said is so important, because we sometimes get looped in with the remote work advocates and zealots who are never dark in the office's doorway again, and, you know, death to the commute and all that good stuff. And really what we're talking about is every company is different. Every organization is different. Every team is different. And everything starts with the work that needs to be done. Then you figure out when, how, and where to do it. But it all starts with the work that needs to be done. And so in some cases, you need a lot of physical proximity. In other cases, you don't need hardly any. But it has to be a decision based on what is it we do and how do we serve our customers and how do we work? And then you can figure out the details of whose butt sits in which chairs.
So yeah. So my position, based on my observations of myself and other companies in this time, is that remote work can work beautifully. Hybrid work can work beautifully, and in-office work can work beautifully. Like, none of them are superior to the other, really. And we're living in a time where, and you both probably know statistics better than I do, but I think I saw something on CNN where they posted two jobs. One was completely remote, one was in the office. 7 times as many resumes were gotten for the remote work. So there's an economic push, I think, a reality of labor that remote work is not going away.
Right? No chance is it going away, right? Like, you know, we published The Long Distance Leader in 2018, and we said, hey, the trend then was more remote work, right? Because of technology, because of globalization, because of a variety of factors, it was already happening. We were already moving that way. And then we had a virus and the genie was out of the bottle. And we are now living in a time that, you know, our grandchildren are going to read case studies about how we worked through not just 2020, 2021, but now, about a time when society views work differently, thinks about the options of work differently. People are considering how work fits into their life differently. And technology and experience now allows us to think differently about when, where, and how work happens. And to Wayne's point earlier, our belief is that organizations, leaders, individuals need to figure out what works best for them to get great results and to take care of people. And that's been a theme throughout all of our books. So even though we talk about long distance, and as Wayne said, people may want to put us into that category, we're really saying, hey, this is the reality. Let's make sure if we're going to do it, we do it exceptionally well, taking advantage of it and thinking about the things that will help us do it exceptionally well, rather than saying someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. We're either all going to come back, which some people want, or no one's going to come back, which some people want. But most of the research actually says that people are perfectly happy coming into the office once in a while, right? At the end of the day, for the reasons that Wayne was talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think that when we start talking about numbers, we have to realize two really important things happened during the pandemic that had not happened in the industrial work period, right? Number one is, we found out through forced experimentation that a lot of jobs that people didn't think could be done remotely can be done perfectly well. Actual productivity dropped very little during the pandemic. So if a job can be done remotely? Should it be? I mean, that's a question we didn't ask before because we just didn't think it was possible. The second thing that happened, and this is really important, and this is why, as Kevin says, we don't know what is going to happen, is that when you give people two and a half years to stop and think about what they're doing and why they're doing it, and is this what I want to keep doing? Turns out people are going to make some different decisions than they do when they're just scrambling as fast as they can. I'll give you an example. For years, we were hearing there was going to be this wave of retirements. And it never came. And it never came for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, people would want to retire and then companies would say, tell you what, come work for us as a consultant and you can keep working and, you know, we'll make it work on the books. And that was great. But the other thing was people were used to it and they were perfectly happy to keep working and there was no desire to retire. Suddenly, with health issues and then people being home and going, oh, this is a good thing. A lot of those people that were scheduled to retire over the last 10 years finally said, the heck with it, I'm done. And a lot of that was, you know what? I'm not going back to the office. The heck with it.
Yep. They didn't mind the work, but like once they saw something different, here's another thing that's interesting and different is that this conversation is different in the US than it is in the rest of the world for a variety of factors, including the fact that we have much longer commutes in general in the US than in the rest of the world. Stuff that I've read just in the last few days from the Wall Street Journal says that, you know, occupancy rates in the US, 40 to 60% office occupancy of pre-pandemic levels, Western Europe, 80, 90%, Asia, 110%. So the conversation that we're having is a different one in some ways than in other parts of the world. And that's important for us to talk about because you might be leading a team that's got people around the world. And so one more reason why their perspective, on top of the 15 other reasons, why their perspective might be different and why that what they're thinking about and what they're worried about and what they're considering are different than what you're thinking about, you know, if you live in Peoria or wherever, right?
There's so many directions we can go because I love this conversation so much. I want to kind of go back to some of the basics that you share in the book, which include what is a team and what is culture. Can you talk about those two things? Because
they're so important. Well, I'll take culture and let Wayne take team. So we think that culture is pretty simple, that it's the way things are done around here. And whenever you put a group of people together for any length of time, you have one. And so people want to make it fancier than that. And they want to put a bunch of words around it. And some people want to think, well, when we went home, we didn't have one anymore. No, you still have one. It might be different than you had pre-pandemic. And of course, one of the big ideas of this book is that you can make conscious decisions about what you want it to be next, right? But culture exists. It's naturally occurring when you put a group of people together. And it will always change. The only question is, how can we decide to have it change in a way that will serve us best?
I think my favorite definition is culture is what the fly sees from the wall.
It's what's really going on. It's also not what the policy states it's what's really happening. The way things are happening. What are we doing? The way we're interacting. I know you'll probably ask us about the three C's, right? How are people communicating? How are people collaborating? What's the level of cohesion amongst this group of people, whatever the proximity is, together or not, right?
I want to go back to what Laurel said, which is really interesting. Culture is what the fly sees on the wall. It's not what you see internal because you can't see it. I mean, at the risk of sounding like an old guy, Marshall McLuhan had this great quote that said, you know, I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't a fish.
Right. I've heard the fish is the last to know it's wet.
Right. Exactly. It's we are so busy doing it and living in it and just assuming that this is how things are that we can't always see our culture for what it is. And that's a large part of what we tried to do in the book, is ask the questions and engage enough people that you can get a 3D view of what is actually going on. And all of that starts with, whose culture are we talking about? It gets back to the team, because there is a macro culture, right? If you think about IBM in the 70s and 80s, white shirt, blue tie, you know, whatever, there was an IBM culture. But were you talking about manufacturing? Were you talking about sales? Were you talking about engineering? Were you talking about the group in Longmont, Colorado versus the group in San Jose? Because there are all these microcultures. So people might say, oh, I know what the IBM culture, I know what XYZ culture is, maybe on the macro level. But what does the microculture look like? Because that's the one that everybody swims in.
Yeah. And that's the one.
My dad was an IBMer, so I'm an IBM kid. So I enjoyed the IBM family culture, which included, this is culture from a five-year-old's viewpoint, walking into the IBM plant in Owego, New York, and there was gigantic piles of gifts, depending on if you were a girl, a boy, and your age. So you would go in and run to the box. And get your present, and Santa Claus would be there. So anyway, that's, and my dad was the, he was the renegade that wouldn't wear white shirts.
Yeah, I think that I'm glad that Wayne brought up micro and macro, because it, and that's a perfectly wonderful example. And even if, you know, some of those who are listening weren't born in the 70s, you still understand it, right? Because you can walk through a company's offices and even feel it. You can feel it, and then you can see the differences. Like the video camera, or like the fly would notice when you walk from one department to the next. And so as an individual, or as an individual leader, we have the opportunity to say, what do we want that to be? And that's one of the big things they're trying to do with this book, is for people to say, okay, what is the culture that, what's the culture that we aspire to? How do we really want to work together? How do we want to get great results? How do we want to get great results, have a good time, and not kill ourselves, right? Not be burnt out, have a great life and get great work results. And it requires culture to do that. And we try to give you a roadmap to help your team figure that out and then operationalize it.
I think one of the reasons managers and leaders should read this book is I think a lot of them are struggling with confidence around culture in a virtual environment. And I think your roadmap will give them more confidence about what to do.
Well, one of the things, and we hear this a lot, you know, people always come to us, did you hear what the chairman of so-and-so said about you better get back to work, or, you know, we're going back to the before times. And I want to cut those people some grace, because they're not doing it necessarily because they're control freaks and they insist everybody be there. They grew up in the industry when things were done a certain way. They were successful networking and seeing each other and working in a certain way. And so that, in their experience, is how one succeeds, and they want people to succeed. They want their people to succeed. They want their organizations to succeed. And there's pressure in industry. You know, certain industries are more accepting of remote work than others. So there's this moment in time, right, where you're dealing with not just the culture of the organization, but the culture of senior leadership, the culture of the industry that you're in, right? If you look at Wall Street, Wall Street is probably banging the drum harder than anybody to get back to work, because you've got 150 years of crazy success based on doing things a certain way. And to change that is scary and weird. And we don't know if this will work, but we know this did. Now, some of it also is wearing rose-colored glasses, because as Kevin said earlier, you know, there's the culture that you had, and a lot of people, their initial reaction is, let's get back to that. Let's return to what we knew. But unless you worked in the Garden of Eden, I'm willing to bet that there were things about the way that work got done and the teams were organized that drove you crazy. And here's your chance to address that.
Not only are we willing to bet that, we know it, because, you know, we've been in business a long time. And people have been asking us about, how do we fix this and how do we change this? And before. So the further we go from the way it was in the before times, the more we view it like the good old days, right? And like, you put any sort of thing and say, oh, the way it used to be, well, then when you start to really look at it, you say, oh, well, that wasn't awesome, and that wasn't awesome, and that could have been better. But we the further we go, the more we begin to idealize that. And when you add that to Wayne's point about senior leaders who were super successful personally, interpersonally, and organizationally in that model, I think Wayne's point about granting people a little grace around that is incredibly valuable, as opposed to just assuming they just are control freaks and want everyone to come back.
But that's also really interesting about return to office, is I don't know too many organizations whose return to office went exactly the way they planned it, because their reaction was, yeah, let's get back to normal as soon as possible. And after about 2 weeks, people started going, oh, that's right, I didn't like this. You know, once you got past, it's so good to see you and catching up, and oh my God, I'm working with other people and this is great. After a while, it was, oh yeah, I remember this used to drive me nuts and I didn't like this. And oh, Bob is doing that thing again.
And there's that 45 minute each way commute, right?
And there's the commute. And after a while, the excitement of getting together wears off. And then it's like, ugh, I'm back in the freeway.
I have a client that gave everyone a choice. So you can work, you can go back to the office if you want to. You can work remotely if you want to. You can be hybrid if you want to. And I've spent a lot of time in their offices the last few months, and I see a lot of working moms in the office because they are away from laundry and distractions, and they can also set their own hours so they can go pick them up. But I'm curious, like, separate from culture, separate from like old school versus new school, age bias, technology, are there personality types that should not work remotely?
Well, I'm not big on the words should and not. I think there are certainly, but I understand your question. I think that there are, that the initial thought everyone has is, well, if you're introverted, this will be awesome for you to work by yourself. And if you're extroverted, you're going to have a hard time with that. And like any generalization, that's probably too broad of a brush, because all of us want and need human interaction. And, you know, we had a pandemic of loneliness and isolation in the United States before we had a virus that we used to call a beer, right? And so the reality is that I don't know that there's a personality type or a communication style that automatically moves us one place or another, but I do think there are mindsets that have an impact. And the mindset that says, I don't think I can, or I don't think I want to, whichever direction that would be, is one that's going to get in the way. So if we can kind of work, do our best to adopt a mindset of possibility and opportunity and flexibility, we probably got a better chance of succeeding.
I'm actually going to take a slightly different view on this, and say that if you are the type of person who is working solely for a paycheck and you're trying to figure out what are the bare minimums that I need to do in order not to get fired, probably working alone by yourself is not going to work. And this isn't about introvert, extrovert, or any of the obvious things, right? It's what's your mindset. One of the things we found during the pandemic, I'll give you the broad brush, then I'll give you a very specific thing, is people who were engaged are super engaged no matter where they sit. People who like their coworkers, like their work, they're excited by what they do, they like the challenge, and they don't have to commute every day are the most engaged workers you've got, because they like their life and they like their work and they're happy. People who are disengaged at work and work remotely are way more likely to leave. And the reason is they haven't formed the kinds of things that create engagement in their life. And therefore, it's a purely transactional situation. And if I decide to leave this job and go for another job where I get to work from home, literally the only thing barrier to that is I got to learn a new password and log on.
I love that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, for that person for whom the mindset is, what's the bare minimum I need to do? I think we believe that that's a relatively small percentage of the population. But when they go to the next place, it's not going to be any better, right? It's going to be just the same because they've brought that with them and it's not serving them. That's for sure.
But I like this idea of mindset and being on purpose. Like if you're working on purpose, we call it soul work. If you're doing the best possible way of expressing your passions and purpose.
The best proof of that, Laurel, is in the first quarter after the pandemic, employee engagement scores went through the roof. I mean, the big concern was, oh my gosh, people aren't going to be engaged. They're all going to scatter to the winds. No, what happened was there was a crisis. We have to pull together. We want to not let our teammates down. We want to keep our jobs. And so employee engagement scores went up radically.
I think people were also really grateful to have community and work.
Yep. And that was the honeymoon phase. It didn't stay there. But during that phase, what that proves to me is that people want to do work that has meaning, that has purpose, that where they feel like they're making a difference. That's what I'll say 95% plus of people really do want that as a human being. And we can create that environment and help people make that choice regardless of where they work. Some people need to hear that to say, can people be engaged in the office? Yes. Some people listening need to hear, can people be engaged working from home? And the answer to both is yes. It's a choice that people make. We as leaders can do things to help them make that choice and to improve the chances that they make that choice to say, I'm in, I'm committed, I'm engaged. And it doesn't have to be about where they're physically working.
So back to the book and the advice that you give and also your just expertise. So if one of our listeners or many of our listeners right now are leading a virtual team and it's going well, but they want it to be excellent, what's some advice or tips or tricks or guidance you can give them right now that can help them go from a good team to an excellent team in a virtual environment?
You want to go first, Wayne?
No, I want you to go first because this is your bailiwick, brother. I mean, you do this every day. And by the way, you know, without sounding obsequious, you know, there are worse people to work for than Kevin, who does a very good job of this.
That was sort of backhanded, but thank you, Wayne. I think the first thing we need to do is I think there are a lot of leaders that have felt enormous pressure to figure this out, all of this, right? Where and when and how and all this stuff of work. They've put enormous pressure on themselves to answer questions that don't necessarily have a singular right answer, right? And I think that one of the very best things that they can do to answer your question, Laurel, and to help themselves is to not try to solve it themselves. Ask their team, hey, my sense is we're doing pretty well. Am I right? Where are we not doing so well? But to your point specifically, what can we do? What can I do? What can we do? Now we're asking a culture question again now. What can we do to get even better? Like, we're doing good. We got no issues. We got no beefs, right? What's the next step? right? You're either getting better or you're getting worse, and we want to get better. So what can we do? You don't have to try to figure it out for yourself as a leader.
I think
you can engage your team in that.
I think that's the thing. We talk about culture. We assume that that's something that's imposed and that is top down. And certainly kind of the initial culture and the, this is how we want this place to be, might come from that because it comes from the founder's vision, or it comes from the fact the company's been around a zillion years and it already exists. But man, you cannot impose culture. And this is why return to office has been a little bit of a car wreck, because people spend a lot of time, certain people spend a lot of time putting policies in place and said, there, that's what we're going to do now. And nope, that's not how it's happening. Again, old white guy quote, Peter Drucker said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And it's absolutely true. So to Kevin's point, you need to include everybody else in this discussion and say, we are trying to figure this out. So what do you like? What don't you like? What do you wish would be better? What, ask the magic wand question. I know it's not possible, but if we could, what?
What would you do if you were in my shoes? Those kinds of questions. And I think that when you get down to it, there's a question that I challenge leaders when I'm teaching workshops, and that leader executives that I'm coaching, I challenge them with this question: do you want to lead simply for compliance, or do you want to lead for commitment? And your answer to that question is profoundly important to the results that you will get. And if we truly want to lead for commitment, which most will say quickly, that's what they want to do, then it leads us to do all the kinds of things, Laurel, that you've encouraged us to talk about during this conversation, which is to engage the group, listen, shut up, observe, be curious, all of those kinds of things, because this isn't us or them. This is not we or they, it's us. It's all of us together. And if we want to get great results, leadership is simply this, getting great results with and through others. And that means it's the merging of the folks doing the work and the folks ultimately responsible for those great results working together to get there. And I think that is at the core of what we believe, and it's at the core of what this book is about. Like, how do you design a team? How do you create a culture? You come together and work on it together. And the book gives you a bunch of ways to help you actually do that.
The other thing, and this is why, part of the reason people wanted to put a strategy in place, and when we go back to the office, this is how we're going to do it, is they were fine with not going to the way it was in the before times. They just wanted to know. They were tired of the ambiguity. They just wanted something to feel solid. And it's not going to work that way. When you engage other people in the culture conversation, it's going to be messy and it's going to be awkward. And they may show you things you don't want to see, or you may find out that the assumptions you're working under are wrong. And that's where one of my favorite phrases that Kevin has, and unfortunately he invented it the minute the book went to press, which is pilot before policy. And a lot of organizations went with policy first and then tried to cram everybody in it. And you
That's
may find-
That's a good one, Kevin, pilot before policy.
Yes, the book was already, in bed before I said it. And then I said it, I'm like, that's pretty good. And then now Wayne says it all the time, so.
Well, I'm very proud because I feel like I followed your advice today, because I had a team meeting today and we had a, we usually do like an opening circle, like a icebreaker kind of arrive there sort of thing. And I asked what was the highlight for their history. So some of the people on the team have worked with me for years, and others are new. And I said, no matter what your history is, if it's a month long or 3 years long, what's been a highlight in your history and what could be better? And we kind of threw out the agenda and talked about communication and transparency for the whole meeting because of the input from that. And I think, and at the end, one of our new colleagues was like, can we have these meetings every week?
No, we have work to do.
Maybe not every week, but we can have it again.
I said, I'll think about that. I think they're more potent if we have them once a month, but I'll think about that. So I think that's an example. I mean, the reality is my team, like many teams, I'm with them on Zoom. Most of the, you know, we do see each other physically once or twice a year. Maybe, you know, some positions like sales, I'll see them more often. And I don't really know what's going on unless I ask them questions and I dig deeper. And I think some of that is just space, creating time and space and not feeling too attached to, well, we have 45 minutes, so I have to get through these 10 things. I think throwing out the agenda is probably a good tip too.
Yeah, let me add one thing to that. Whether it's in the group team meeting or whether it's in your one-on-ones, I'll frame it from the one-on-one and say that if we want the time, if we value finding out how they're doing, trying to be more empathetic, trying to get their perspective, trying to check in on their mental fitness, all of those things, then you have to start there. It has to be the first thing that we do. So if I have a meeting with Wayne, he keeps a list that he calls his Kevin list, and I have a Wayne list. But the first thing we do is talk about how we're doing, what's going on, and not just work and weather, right? And if we do that first, and sometimes that might take longer, Laurel, to kind of opening the question to your bigger meeting. But if we don't do it first, we won't get to it. And by doing it first, we get to it, but we're also, as the leader, telling our team members through our actions that they matter and that my boss cares. And sometimes when we're at a distance, people start to wonder those things.
Well, and the dynamics of the meeting are such that there are two problems with working remotely or working hybrid. And one of the things is that you're missing all the visual cues, even if you're on camera and all that stuff. It's obviously clearly not the same. The other thing that's different is there's white space. There's a lot of white space. We've talked, we've set expectations. I trust you to go get the work done, but I don't know what's happening in that time. And if we've got a good relationship, if we've built trust, if you've given me no reason to suspect otherwise, I'm going to be trusting and give you that space. The minute I start to get suspicious or leery or get the sense that something's wrong, we try to compress that white space and fill it up. And once it starts to go bad, we seldom assume the best case scenario. So what you have to do is you have to do those check-ins, those emotional, psychological, social check-ins with our folks so that we can allow that white space to exist. Because the communication can become very transactional. And that's where you get to Kevin's thing, but you got to have the discussion about how you're doing first. Because if you just get to, okay, what's on Wayne's list, what's on Kevin's list, it becomes completing the list and then we go back to work because we're conducting a transaction.
Yeah, we would call that, you know, having compassion, you know, for your fellow worker, your colleague, your teammate. You know, like today, and also in our meeting, we found out that one of our colleagues losing her grandmother, you know, so we had to, you know, we were happy to create space for that. But creating enough time for the human connection and I like what you said about mental fitness, because I also think, you know, separate from remote work and hybrid work, we're in a time where people are struggling with addiction, with stress, with mental illness, with a lot of things. It could be them, it could be family members. What do you tell leaders, managers who might suspect that one of their remote workers is struggling with some sort of mental stress?
Well, I think we have to recognize what is in our bucket and what's not, right? Chances are that most of the leaders who are listening are not trained psychologists, et cetera. And so I think we need to, if we're doing our best to keep a pulse, and if we've done our, and if we've worked hard to build the relationship and trust so that people are comfortable sharing with us, then hopefully we don't get to a place where, oh my gosh, this is what's going on. Like we're sort of aware. And then I think, you know, certainly in larger organizations, you have resources where you can send people to get help. And we want to use those resources without a stigma being attached, and really, you know, coming from an intention of helping people be more effective and being healthier, et cetera. And so, and if we're in a smaller organization where maybe those resources don't automatically exist, then we as leaders need to be figuring out what can we do to help people get the help and support that they need that goes beyond what we're capable of delivering, both based on our training and honestly based on our role, because we're still their boss, which isn't exactly this, doesn't always serve us in helping them in those other ways.
I mean, we unfortunately, the upside of all this tech, there's a lot of technology available, including remote mental health
for sure
professionals, and they're finding that some of the tech apps are even better than being in the room with the psychologist. So I think we're technology is creating some tools that are affordable and helpful, but I think that's good advice to understand what's in our bucket and what's not in our bucket. Is there anything else you want to say to the audience about how to be a, you know, how to create a better team?
Creating teams. We've been creating teams for thousands of years, right? Context is different today. The way in which we need to do it might be a little different, but there's way more the same than different. Don't forget everything you already know about group dynamics and about human behavior, and throw that all out while you're trying to figure out how to do it at a distance, because it's more the same than different. The differences matter. We need to be intentional about those. We need to work to understand those differences better, but don't forget everything you already knew, both as a leader and as a teammate.
And the other thing that I would say, and this sounds self-serving because our job is to sell a book, right? And amazingly enough, what I'm about to say is in the book. It's very, very hard to ad lib or improv the kind of deep thinking and questions that we need to ask when we're looking at our, especially at the structure and design of our team. It's easy to get caught up in emotion. So have a framework, whether it's ours or whether it's somebody else's, I don't care. But plan ahead of time what questions are you going to ask and who are you going to ask and what are you going to do with that information so that you can be very rigorous in your inquiry and not get caught up or hang up the phone and go, oh man, you know what I should have said. But have a structure and a format to do that inquiry with. It's just so important.
And I will plug all three of your books, because I'm a big proponent of well-written, well-organized leadership books as a way to learn about, and not necessarily learn, but become excellent and become contemplative around being a better leader, about being a better compassionate leader. I don't think being in webinars and listening to podcasts are the same as reading a good leadership book. I believe that you need to pick something up, read it, think about it, put it down, revisit it the next day. There's something beautiful about picking up an actual paper book. So pick up these three books. Kevin and Wayne, please tell us how we can get in touch with you and how we can get your books.
Well, if you can spell our names, Wayne Turmel or Kevin Eikenberry, you can find us on LinkedIn. We're both active there. It's a good place to find us and connect with us and tell us where you found us, and we'd love to be connected with you there. You can certainly go to our main company website, which is my name, Kevin Eikenberry, KevinEikenberry.com, KevinEikenberry.com. You can go there to learn about all of the variety of things that we do, find our podcasts, find newsletters, find our blog, and find all of the products and services that we offer, but specifically related to the book and to the books. You can go to longdistanceteambook.com. And we hope that you'll do that. And what we really hope that you'll do most is that you'll take action on something that we talked about today.
Thank you both very much. I enjoyed our conversation. I look forward to more in the future.
Thanks.
Us too. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.